the Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Welcome to this edition of the Peter B. Collins Show, delivered to your earbuds over the internets, you know, a series of tubes. And I want you to become vice president of marketing in your zip code. As you're listening, email 10 friends and tell them that they can get the Peter B. Collins Show free at iTunes or right there at my website at peterbcollins.com. In a moment, Scott Horton will join us. We're going to talk about Karl Rove's, testimony, but it was just responses to questions in an interview from the House Judiciary Committee about, of course, the Siegelman case and the firing of U.S. attorneys. We'll talk about other issues with Scott Horton, too. Later in this program, the Coburns. Andrew and Leslie Coburn invite you to view their new documentary about the Wall Street meltdown. See how I flip those? It's called American Casino. And on our program today, Gary Chu, our official film reviewer, with a review of the new British satire called In the Loop. That's all ahead on the Peter B. Collins Show. And I want to thank listeners for their support in launching our new podcast, including Peggy and Alex Anderson. They just moved to St. Paul to find work. Good luck to you there. And Deborah Gordon of San Francisco is now a monthly supporter of the Peter B. Collins Show. You can help, too. Just go to my website at peterbcollins.com. And as we get ready to introduce Scott Horton, we have to trot out the theme music that we used for Alberto Gonzalez, the failed attorney general, as he tried to explain away the firing of those U.S. attorneys. And the amnesia was so deep. It was over 60 times, he said. And perhaps Gonzalez, who's unemployed, was texting to Karl Rove as Karl sat for 12 grueling hours of questions that he dodged about the firing of U.S. attorneys, the politicization of the Justice Department, and the saga of Don Siegelman, the former Democratic governor of Alabama. Scott Horton, of course, is a legal affairs and national security writer for Harper's Magazine. He's an adjunct professor at the Columbia Law School. And he's been very generous with his time. Thanks for joining us today, Scott. How are you?
Hey, great to be with you, Peter.
Well, I wanted to talk first about the Rove affair. And first of all, could you explain the ground rules and the negotiations that went on this year between Greg Craig, the White House counsel, and representatives of John Conyers' House Judiciary Committee that resulted in this very unusual interview where Karl Rove was generally non-responsive, but Adam Schiff, a congressman from California, was the lead questioner of the former White House operative, Karl Rove. And this is the most convoluted case of executive privilege and non-cooperation that I've seen in, well, mostly in my lifetime.
Well, that's right. I mean, we go back to the first quarter of 2007, after it suddenly became apparent that Rove was deeply involved in this firing of nine U.S. attorneys that later became called the U.S. attorney scandal. And simultaneously, he was being linked to a number of other suspiciously political prosecutions, like the one involving Governor Siegelman in Alabama. And the House Judiciary Committee decided to summon him to testify. They had negotiations that went on for many, many months for him to appear. He declined. Then they issued a subpoena. He didn't appear in reaction to the subpoena. They issued a second subpoena. He stood them up on that, too. Then finally they began a court action, which they won. A George W. Bush-appointed judge concluded that there was no merit to his claims of executive privilege in defiance of the congressional subpoena. And that went on with a legal appeal. Then, of course, we came to the 2008 election, Obama came into the White House. And, of course, the exercise of presidential privilege is really controlled by the current occupant of the White House. So with that turnover, it became Greg Craig's say to what extent the presidential claim of executive privilege could continue to be asserted. So he got right in the middle of this negotiation. Well, interesting thing, Greg Craig was representing the White House and Barack Obama in this process, but not known to many people is the fact that Karl Rove was a client of Greg Craig's, specifically a client of his law firm, Williams & Connolly.
Mm-hmm.
And Craig had been involved advising him several times previously, particularly in connection with negotiation of some book contracts. So they knew each other very well and had a very friendly relationship. And they wound up negotiating this deal with the House Judiciary Committee, which I would say was surprisingly friendly to Karl Rove. So the Obama White House, represented by Greg Craig, struck a deal that helped out Karl Rove a great deal.
And, of course, Karl's returned the favor by saying really nice things about the Obama administration on Fox News.
Not. You can count on that being a one-way street.
Now, I'm a little uncomfortable with this because I believe that we should have arm's-length types of relationships here. And there have been some rumors that Greg Craig might be eased out of the White House. I just heard them once. Don't know if there's really any basis to them. But fundamentally, there's a deep conflict of interest here, and he should not have been the person, the point person on those negotiations.
Yeah, that's definitely my view. I guess I back up and say I know Greg Craig, and I like him a lot. And I think very highly of him. But I was disappointed that he managed this and stuck his nose in it personally when he had a pretty obvious conflict. He shouldn't have done it. It should have been turned over to one of his staff. But, you know, that's water under the bridge right now. Deal was struck. The committee got the main thing they wanted, which is Karl Rove's testimony. They also got the lion's share of the documents they wanted, not all the documents, but the large majority of the documents. They were also able to get the testimony of Harriet Myers. And I think there's no question but that the documents and the testimony advance our understanding of what went on substantially. And they also make it completely clear that Karl Rove is a slippery, unbelievable weasel.
Mm-hmm. Now, in some analysis of Karl Rove's commentary, I want to call it testimony, but I don't think that's fair to people who really testify under oath. Larissa Alexandrovna, who's been following these issues, and I credit her, along with you, Scott, in really driving coverage of the Don Siegelman case, which we'll reference here in a moment. But she pointed out that Karl Rove's op-ed in the August 20th edition of the Wall Street Journal had an interesting little admission, and that is, when exactly was the president informed of the decision to fire U.S. attorneys? And therefore, does executive privilege apply? Because executive privilege is designed to allow the president to get frank and honest counsel from his staff members. But if the president only signed off on this in a perfunctory manner and was not going back and forth saying, should we fire Iglesias? Should we prosecute Siegelman again? Then how can executive privilege be invoked when the executive was not really involved in these deliberations?
Well, that's a key point here. And I think the formulation of executive privilege that's most widely accepted is that it shields communications between the president and his advisors. I think everybody would agree that's covered by the executive privilege. But all these other communications, especially communications that go on between Karl Rove and people outside of the White House, it's almost impossible to understand how that can be covered by executive privilege. Nevertheless, we've got, you know, four significant documents here with respect to which executive privilege was claimed. We know a little bit about those documents, but not a lot. And one of the things we know is that the president was directly involved in these decisions to terminate U.S. attorneys. In particular, he was involved in the decision to terminate David Iglesias, the U.S. attorney in New Mexico. And my understanding right now is that the special prosecutor, Nora Danahy, who's investigating the U.S. attorney scandal, she is focusing her attention hawk-like on these things that went on in New Mexico. And this is the area where we're most likely to see some indictments issue.
Mm-hmm. And that's where, of course, the senator and a leading congresswoman there both intervened, pushing David Iglesias to issue some indictments just before the 2006 midterm elections, and he refused to do so. Iglesias describes himself as outraged by this op-ed that Rove published in the Murdoch Wall Street Journal, because Rove took the opportunity to take a couple of swipes at Mr. Iglesias. And let me quote a couple of lines here. "I also told the White House counsel about complaints that Mr. Iglesias bungled a high-profile corruption case by interfering with career prosecutors and that he shelved an indictment involving corruption in the construction of the Bernalillo County Courthouse for months. The accusation was that he refused to file the indictments until after the 06 election out of fear that he might offend Democrats he would need if he ran for office himself." Now, this is a classic Rove tactic, is it not?
It's a series of completely outrageous lies, which the documents that we've seen and the testimony that have come in establish as lies. So here are the facts. It's not the case that he shelved an indictment. It is the case that he managed a criminal investigation and was prepared to indict a prominent New Mexico Democrat named Manny Aragon, who had been involved in the Bernalillo courthouse construction very, very corruptly, mm-hmm. And who, in fact, was charged, was tried, and was convicted on those counts. So really, that criminal prosecution was never in question. The question was the timing of the prosecution. And on that score, the United States Department of Justice rules, the manual for U.S. attorneys, tells the U.S. attorney, you may not bring an indictment in a current election cycle if it is likely to have an impact on the election.
That's right.
He was instructed by the ethics rules binding on him not to bring it. Notwithstanding that fact, the Congresswoman Heather Wilson, who would have benefited most from this indictment, and Pete Domenici and Karl Rove were all bringing intense pressure on him to do this. That is, to violate the binding guidelines of the Department of Justice for the political advantage of the Republican Party. All this idea of him buttering up Democrats is ludicrous nonsense. I mean, of course, he actually brought the indictments and he prosecuted and he secured convictions. So how are the Democrats liking that? Not at all, of course.
Yeah.
This demonstrates again how Karl Rove has no compunction about recounting just flagrant lies. And why is he doing this? He's doing it to protect himself, because what he was doing constitutes obstruction of justice. The technical language is corruptly influencing a criminal investigation. And the law is very, very clear that if you attempt to affect the timing of a criminal prosecution for partisan political gain, which is exactly what Karl Rove did, that is corruptly influencing a pending criminal case, and that's a felony.
Now,
and
Scott,
I think there's a significant chance he is going to be indicted on this and other things.
Mm-hmm. Now, Scott, the paragraph that I just read and that you just picked apart is the foundation for the whopper that follows. The allegations about Mr. Iglesias were similar to those judiciary Democrats and their media allies raised against me, that the judicial process had been manipulated for political reasons. Isn't that amazing?
It is amazing. I mean, you know, but it's Karl Rove just turning the world on its head. You know, there's the comic book a concept of bizarro world, where everything is exactly the opposite of the way it is in the real world. And Karl Rove lives in bizarro world.
Yeah, he sure does. Now, there are a few other lines here that I'd like to just serve up for your reaction. Here's one. Judging from the evidence released, it uncovered facts that show my role in the U.S. attorney's issue was minimal and entirely proper.
Completely untrue. In fact, 6,000 pages of documents show Karl Rove is smack in the middle of the entire process, engaged continuously in possibly criminal conduct. We just talked about what happened in New Mexico. We could talk about what happened next door in Arizona, where there was a criminal case involving Congressman Renzi.
Mm-hmm.
And just before the 2006 election, Rove intervened very heavily with the Justice Department, trying to pressure them to make a false statement protecting Renzi, saying, oh, there basically is nothing going on here, just ignore this and move on. And in fact, he was indicted, 30 counts. He's getting ready for trial right now out in Arizona. Very serious. So the Justice Department made false statements to the press to help Renzi win re-election in 2006, all because of Karl Rove. The documents are in there showing it.
Mm-hmm.
And we can trace his involvement in cases in 6 or 7 other jurisdictions. They show up there. But one thing that's consistent in all these cases is when a Republican official wanted to influence the Justice Department to do something, to squelch a criminal investigation, to put out information about a criminal investigation, to go after a Democrat, who did they call? Karl Rove. Mm-hmm. Every single time. They all understood that Karl Rove was the man who would make whatever they wanted to have happen in justice happen. In fact, even just this week, we've had a number of disclosures concerning Chris Christie, the former U.S. attorney in New Jersey. And one thing that the New York Times pointed out, when Chris Christie wanted to be appointed as U.S. attorney in New Jersey, to whom did he turn? Karl Rove. He sent his resume to Karl Rove, pointed out he'd raised $350,000 for the Bush campaign, and said he wanted to be U.S. attorney in New Jersey, and they had some conversations. And they had conversations about him running ultimately to be the Republican candidate for governor in New Jersey, a package deal.
All right, here's another line from the Rove piece in the Wall Street Journal. No fair-minded person can review the thousands of pages of documents and testimony and conclude that I drove the process. Instead, the committee seems to have found only evidence that discredits the idea that I orchestrated the firings to protect Republicans or punish Democrats. The committee found nothing to indicate that I ordered U.S. attorneys in Arizona, California, or Wisconsin to be removed to sabotage investigations of Republicans, as some judiciary Democrats have alleged.
Exactly the opposite. No person who's capable of reading and understanding what he reads would conclude anything other than that Karl Rove was in the midst of the process, driving it from the beginning, and that he corruptly used his position and authority in the White House to politicize the dealings of the U.S. attorneys. I just quote you again the case in New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
He says he had no involvement in the firing of David Iglesias. The testimony of Harriet Myers. She says the last week of September, Karl Rove was in New Mexico at a political fundraiser, and a highly agitated Karl Rove called her on the phone saying, we have a problem. This David Iglesias is a big problem. And then she says, I can't remember the exact words, but it was something like, we have to get rid of him.
Yeah.
And of course, it's right after that that he winds up being gotten rid of. So, you know, how can you look at this evidence and the documents that back it up on every single point and come away with any conclusion other than he's the man who implemented the firing of David Iglesias and see exactly why? David Iglesias refused to bring a prosecution of a Democrat right before the election, 2 weeks before the election, in order to affect the results.
Now, Scott, as we've discussed before, I believe the Siegelman case is something that could crack open many doors related to Karl Rove and wrongdoing by the Bush administration. There's a stolen election. There's one indictment brought that was dismissed, and then a second one was brought. These are clearly politically motivated charges to take out an opponent. We have the whistleblower testimony of Dana Jill Simpson that Carl's girls, referring to the two U.S. attorneys, Alice Martin and Laura Canary, Canary married to Bill Canary, Karl Rove's former business partner in political campaigns in Alabama, that really does indicate that Rove was certainly well aware of, if not driving, the process to railroad Don Siegelman into federal prison. And I believe that if we can unravel all this because of the tainted U.S. attorneys there, the stolen election, I think, is a critical issue. And the way that, you know, a judge who should have recused himself heard the case, all of these were matters that appear, at any rate, to have been highly political. And in the op-ed that Rove wrote, he just gets to the Siegelman case at the very end and is very dismissive of the way that the questioning occurred in his interview. Let me just read this one paragraph. Judiciary Democrats asked little about Don Siegelman's bribery conviction, despite overheated assertions by the New York Times, Scott Pelley of 60 Minutes, and various MSNBC talking heads that I was behind the prosecution of the former governor. And here he, of course, takes another swipe at the witness I just referenced. Judiciary Democrats didn't get testimony either from Siegelman or Dana Jill Simpson, the eccentric Alabama lawyer who drew attention by publicly supporting the allegations. Committee staff confided to me that they considered her an unreliable witness. I also understand that Siegelman and Simpson refused to cooperate with the Justice Department's review of the claim of political persecution, while I willingly gave sworn testimony. I mean, this...
Every single one of those statements is a lie, and he knows it's a lie. I mean, you know, just start with the fact that Dana Jill Simpson gave testimony under oath for 6 hours before the Judiciary Committee. And he says, well, she didn't call and she didn't testify. No, she gave testimony for 6 hours, subject to cross-examination, swearing an oath at the beginning, which he refused to do. He only came and gave testimony after 2 years of legal battles, and then only when it was clear he would have been forced under a legal coercion to do so. He also tried to obstruct at every step, producing documents. Jill Simpson produced all her documents. Then the claims that committee staff considered her to be unreliable. Well, in fact, I've spoken with committee staff. They told me they thought she was an incredibly compelling and reliable witness on every count. But, you know, don't take my word for it. Look at the Judiciary Committee's report that they issued. It relies extensively on her testimony, quoting it over and over again, referring also to documents she produced that corroborate her testimony on all these critical points. Is Judiciary Committee staff going to do that if they think a witness is unreliable? This is just a lie from Karl Rove, another lie. And why is he so concerned about this Republican woman from Alabama, this Republican lawyer, mm-hmm. because he's vulnerable? This is one of several witnesses now who can connect him directly to the corrupt influencing of this prosecution against Governor Siegelman. But I'll tell you, there's some more. I mean, you know, I completed interviews recently of members of the prosecution team who were involved with Siegelman who have described to me what went on inside that prosecution. And I'll just tell you, it validates step by step almost everything that's been written critically about the prosecution. And what I heard over and over again was, you know, my worst and darkest suspicions about what was going on never went quite far enough. It was even more corrupt. And people inside the prosecution corroborate specifically that it was well known and understood that this prosecution was being driven by high-ranking political figures in Alabama and Washington, specifically including Karl Rove. That was a point of common discussion inside the U.S. Attorney's Office.
Yeah. And I want to reference for our listeners two sources. One is the public record website, pubrecord.org. And there is a piece that was written by Dana Jill Simpson, which shows the web of connections and conflicts of interest of various parties related to the Siegelman prosecution. And I think that you should take a look at that. Also, Roger Schuler, who blogs as legalschnauzer.blogspot.com, has done a great job on the ground there in Alabama of explaining a lot of those players, and I think that he offers some very interesting additions to this, too. And, Scott, the interviews you just referred to, will those show up in Harper's or on your blog?
Well, we'll see. Soon enough. I'm working on them in connection with a larger project, shall I say. I can't say anything more about it at the moment.
Okay. I won't press you any further. Anything else you'd like to add about the Siegelman case? Because I am floored that the Holder Justice Department has refused to intervene and dismiss the charges, and that we are seeing the prospect that Holder Justice is recommending an even longer sentence for Don Siegelman for this persecution.
Correct. And not only that, but one of the whistleblowers inside the prosecution team was fired, and the authority to fire happened under Eric Holder's watch. And in addition to that, interviewing, again, people inside the U.S. Attorney's Office. This woman was fired based on accusations that people inside the U.S. Attorney's Office tell me they knew were completely bogus and untrue. And they said Washington and Laura Canary were desperate to get rid of this whistleblower and to discredit her. So, again, you see this tremendous abuse of power going on. And no effort by the Justice Department in Washington to check it in any way. It's an absolutely disgraceful situation.
Scott Horton, this links directly to Holder's view on prosecutions or investigations leading to prosecutions of those responsible at the top for the torture policies implemented during the Bush years. And once again, I'm quite distressed that this idea that we have to look forward and can't, go back and examine these issues and provide accountability is not just a lost opportunity. I think that it's a very significant abuse of our criminal justice process to selectively turn a blind eye to the most obvious and egregious violations of our laws and our international treaties is unconscionable to me. Yet it seems that Holder is going to try to do what Nixon would call the limited hangout route.
Modified limited hangout, I think, is the word. Well, I think we're going to see some major developments on Monday. So hang tight and let's see how it turns out. Monday, the CIA Inspector General's report is going to be released. I'm told by people in the Justice Department the Office of Professional Responsibilities report that's 5 years in the making, talking about the torture lawyers and the torture memoranda, that's going to be released. And I'm told right in the wake of those two things, Attorney General Holder will announce his decision on the appointment of a special prosecutor. I'm told he will appoint a special prosecutor. But I'm also told, don't keep your hopes up. He's probably going to put blinders on this special prosecutor, telling him, just look at what went on in those detention cells with the CIA agents, and don't bother your pretty little head with things that went on involving policymakers in high positions in Washington. If that's what happens, that's a travesty. In fact, that's worse than doing nothing. It's another cover-up. It's another scapegoat the grunts, just like happened after Abu Ghraib.
Now, Scott, I believe that Pat Fitzgerald willingly put blinders on his own investigation into the CIA leak case, and all we came up with was a very flimsy conviction of Scooter Libby. The underlying issues were never fully examined, and no one was held accountable for
it. Karl Rove was not indicted, and I'm told that Patrick Fitzgerald's staff felt that they had an airtight case against Karl Rove.
Mm-hmm. And so how can Holder appoint a special prosecutor and limit his or her purview to this idea that, well, we only want to go for the people who were interrogating subjects and went beyond the John Yoo J. Bybee memos?
He can't do that consistent with the law. The law is very, very clear. A special prosecutor is appointed to investigate a crime. You identify the crime. He's supposed to develop the facts and follow them wherever they go. So it's explicitly improper for the Attorney General to say, don't look behind door A, don't look behind door B, only look behind door C. in terms of who could be targets of an investigation, that would be seriously abusive. And yet that is what I'm told, exactly what some of Eric Holder's aides are advising him to do. So I think we're just going to have to wait and see on Monday, you know, does he do the right thing or does he do something that's corrupt?
And would he do it overtly where he would say, you know, this is the range of this investigation, or would it be done, you know, with winks and nods where they select somebody to conduct this who will accept a leash?
Well, that's the key question. I mean, really, it all boils down to the integrity and independence of the person appointed as special prosecutor. Is it really an independent person, a person of integrity who's widely respected and who is outside the Justice Department, or is a special prosecutor who's appointed someone who is Eric Holder's sock puppet? And, you know, if it's someone who's close to Eric Holder and who works at the Department of Justice now, I'd be very suspicious.
Mm-hmm. Now, Scott Horton, the other area where I'm distressed is on the continued assertion, in fact, extension of the state secret privilege in issues related to the NSA domestic surveillance program. I refuse to use the euphemism of warrantless wiretap because before the 2007 FISA law was jammed through, these things were illegal, and I believe that they are still unconstitutional under the Fourth Amendment. The wiretapping continues unabated. Mark Klein, who sat for an exclusive interview for my podcast, and I recommend it if you haven't listened to it yet, detailed not only how the system worked and the Israeli-built technology that was used to sift through the massive data that was scooped up in San Francisco and as many as 20 other locations around the country, but he details how when he went to the media, for example, the Los Angeles Times, he gave them his documents, he showed them what was going on, and instead of running a story, they took that information to the head of the NSA at the time and left him exposed and unprotected. Not only that, he begged to testify before the Intelligence Committee of either the House or the Senate, and they have simply stiff-armed him. And as I see it, Holder is extending the bad law, the bad precedents established by the Bush administration in this arena. And I don't see any prospect right now for a return to our full Fourth Amendment rights, which require probable cause and a court order before an American citizen can be surveilled.
Well, that's exactly right. We've seen basically a complete failure by Congress to exercise any meaningful oversight over NSA. Remember, they told us they needed these extraordinary powers, which I believe are illegal, unconstitutional powers, which couldn't be granted to them by Congress to begin with,
yeah,
and which were seized by them against criminal prohibitions, which should have been prosecuted by the Justice Department.
Amen.
So, you know, they did all this. Now the Inspector General's studied what they did, and they also asked the question, was there any benefit at all from this? And the answer was no, not an iota, not a paperclip. No benefit came from these extraordinary illegal powers. And that provides a very compelling justification for taking this away, returning the situation to the status quo ante, going back to a rule where, yes, you want to snoop on somebody, you get a warrant. And if it's national security concerns rather than criminal law concerns, you go to the FISA court to get your warrant. But no more warrantless surveillance. I mean, this is the compelling, this is the obviously what should happen, but the Obama administration is delighted to have all the power to snoop that the Bush administration had. They're not going to give up, and they're not going to give an inch on any of this. And when we look at many of these pending lawsuits, they continue to make arguments, just as the Bush administration does, that, well, you can't even look at this because of national secrets. And they're now using national secrets, state secrets, as a sword to attack defense lawyers. They've opened an investigation into the workings of defense counsel at Guantanamo on the theory that they had photographs of CIA agents who were involved in torture at the black sites, and they were showing these photographs to prisoners trying to identify who was involved in interrogating them. And the government is saying, this is a violation of state secrets. It's saying, no, you can't investigate what we did to your client. You can't ask your client to identify who tortured him. If you do that, we will criminalize you. What's all this all about? What is driving this concern with state secrecy? Criminality. It's because crimes were committed in these black sites. They are scared to death that people will put together a case identifying who committed these crimes. That may not be prosecuted by the U.S. Justice Department. In fact, I think we can say safely it will never be. But it may very well be prosecuted by other law enforcement agencies around the world. In fact, we have a pending criminal trial going on now in Italy. We have two pending criminal investigations in Spain. Mm-hmm. We have another one in Germany, another one in Poland. They're very concerned that these criminal investigations will lead to the prosecution of American agents. So we see state secrets being asserted basically to obstruct justice.
And I just want to add a quick aside here that I'm doing a podcast series with Sibel Edmonds. She's the FBI whistleblower who was subjected to a gag order under the state secret privilege. And remarkably, she was permitted to give a deposition in August in a case involving Ohio Congresswoman Jean Schmidt, where she did articulate many of the things that she has wanted to talk about over the last 5 years when she was subject to that gag order. So that's a little break in the continuity from this new administration. But I still have to ask why, and you may not have an answer, but you could speculate, why would a constitutional law professor, a former one like Barack Obama, actually extend the bad law of the Bush administration? Why would he protect the wrongdoing of people like Dick Cheney, who continues to pepper him from the stands and is a real pain in the ass? And why would he want to cover up the wrongdoing in the past with this mindless mantra of, I'm moving forward, not looking backward?
I'll give you an answer, and it's Lord Acton's answer. Those who have power never want to relinquish it. So, of course, he criticized Bush for grabbing and taking to himself all this extra-legal power. He did that during the election campaign. Now, however, he's president, and that power is his, and he's simply not going to give it up. And that's an axiom that historians have been observing for centuries.
Yeah.
Those who have power never want to relinquish it.
Well, we've got a real struggle going forward, Scott, and I just want to thank you for the work that you've been doing, pushing for torture investigations and accountability, pushing for exposure of Karl Rove and the Siegelman case, and many other issues that you are concerned about and write about. And you do have a blog called No Comment that people can find at Harper's Magazine online. That's harpers.org. And you also do some blogging over at the Daily Beast, right?
Yes, and Huffington Post as well.
And Huffington Post. Scott, thanks for spending time with us today. We'll check back with you in the near future and keep tabs on these issues.
Yes, great to be with you again.
Thank you, Scott.
Bye.
Those who want to forget the past are doomed to repeat it. The Peter B. Collins Show is sponsored by the Organic Wine Company. Now that you're eating organic, it's time to drink organic. Try the fine, earth-friendly wines imported by the Organic Wine Company since 1980. Just click on the link on my homepage at peterbcollins.com for a special introductory offer for Peter B. Collins listeners. Still to come on this edition of the Peter B. Collins Show, our official film critic, Gary Chu, reviews the British satire In the Loop. And there's another film that is debuting in San Francisco this weekend, in New York, September 2nd. It's a documentary about the mortgage meltdown in the United States called American Casino. And joining me today are co-producers Leslie Coburn and Andrew Coburn. And this, for me, completes the Coburn quadfecta. I've met, I think, all of them now. Leslie, Andrew, welcome to the program today.
Hey, we're glad to be here.
It's nice to talk with you, and I've met I've met Patrick and talked with Alexander on many occasions, and I appreciate the contributions to American and international journalism that this very talented family has made.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Leslie, you hail from San Francisco, so welcome back to the Left Coast.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So American Casino is a powerful documentary about not just what happened on Wall Street, but, you know, they like to talk about Wall Street and Main Street. And I often think about Elm Street, which is where the real nightmares have occurred. Because there are many people who signed on to these subprime mortgages who didn't have to, who qualified for a prime mortgage that did not have an adjustable rate, that was not going to escalate them out of their homes. And you try to probe for, you know, where the real problem originated. Leslie, with your background at 60 Minutes and Frontline, you've made many investigative broadcast pieces, and this is your first feature documentary film. Tell us what you were gunning for, what you wanted to deliver to the viewer.
Well, we started shooting this in January of 2008, so it was quite a while before everyone else realized that the situation was so dire. I mean, the crash was in the fall of 2008. And at the time, both Andrew and I could see, we could see there were very serious problems on Wall Street, and there were foreclosures every 3 minutes on the courthouse steps of various cities around us. So we decided that the most important thing we could do was to connect the dots between the two in a way that would really make people understand what has happened to people and why and who is responsible. You know, we hear a lot that we're all responsible for this. And in this investigation, we found that that's absolutely not the case. There were many people who were duped into their mortgages, people who believed that lenders and bankers were, that you could trust them, like you could trust a doctor or a lawyer, and they found that they had made a terrible mistake.
Mm-hmm. And so let's first talk about the lending side of this, because I know a lot of people who want to blame the borrowers and who tend to let the lenders off the hook, saying, well, gosh, you know, people came in with them and filled out phony documents. They knew what they were doing. But as your title suggests, American Casino, they were gambling with money, and the people who actually originated the loans knew that they were going to sell them off in short order and never have to face the music of a default, a foreclosure, a short sale, any of those eventualities. And, you know, tell me, Leslie, in your view, you know, how much responsibility do the lenders bear for no-doc loans, for 110% loans? They knew what they were doing. They're the experts in finance.
Right. I mean, the lenders bear a tremendous responsibility here. You know, a lot of the biggest lenders, over 300 of them, have now gone bust. And that's because they were financed in these efforts by major banks. So when you start following the money here, The real desire for these subprime loans, which are, in financial terms, high yields. You know, you make a lot of money off a subprime loan. You make much when you're pulling in 11% loans at 11%. You can make quite a lot of money. So the people who were really pushing for these were the bankers. We have a banker in shadow in this film, who's from Bear Stearns, who talks about this, and he talks about how they had to feed the demand for these securitized instruments, these CDOs. So they were pulling in more and more loans. And the lenders, we have brokers, people in the film, who tell you outright. They say, you know, the notion of a liar loan, well, there were liar loans, but it was the brokers who were lying. It wasn't the people who were trying to get the loans. If you said you made, you know, $2,500 a month, they would write in the blank that you made $2,500 a week.
The important thing to remember is one of the basic facts that happened is that traditionally, when you know banks lent money, they lent it on the basis of the borrower's perceived ability to repay. In this bubble, they didn't care. They didn't really care whether you could repay the money or not. All they wanted to do was make a loan, have a loan on the books, which they could then sell to someone else and take a fee off the top. That's why, you know, with such a policy as mad as that, that's why the whole thing has collapsed in ruins.
Mm-hmm. And Andrew, as we saw this develop and we saw things start to crumble in markets like Las Vegas and Phoenix, which had the big run-ups in the early aughts, and then by 2005, they had peaked and were starting to decline. Those were kind of the canaries in the coal mine, but those signals were ignored. And the Greenspan Fed kept money, the interest rates very low. And as you point out in the film, that was one of the contributors to the need for the high yields from subprime loans.
Well, that's right. I mean, it was he was keeping interest low, so they could, the banks, they could borrow money. Money was very cheap for them, as it is again now. And then they could, pump it out again in these basically what were predatory loans to poor people. I mean, it wasn't just Greenspan. Amazing, the canaries in the mine were toppling over. The mines were toppling over like ninepins in the 2005 and 2006. You mentioned Arizona and Nevada and also mm-hmm. California. And yet there was this willful blindness at the top. Ben Bernanke, our present federal chairman, he was saying, still saying in 2007 that the subprime business could be contained. It wasn't really going to infect anything else. So they, as we show in the film, there was a sort of escalating. The banks told everyone else that house prices would never go down, and they sort of convinced each other too,
mm-hmm.
While at the same time, making side bets that maybe they would. It's such a tale of mad greed, which people, when they see the film, come away a bit astonished.
Well, the other thing is that the banks, the same time they were, bundling up all these millions of loans and then selling them off to investors, they set up an index called the ABX, which allowed them to bet at the same time that people would default on their loans. So they, it's an outrageous situation where they were going to make money both ways.
Well, and that's why the name of your film is so apt, because I'm a craps player, a low level. I lose $100 and I walk away. But in craps, you can play with the shooter and against the shooter at the very same time. And that's what you just described. As they originated bad loans and fed them into the derivative system, they were also betting against them. And then we had AIG and presumably others who were writing insurance on these bets.
Right, writing insurance, which they had in the expectation they would never have to pay out, and with no possibility, they had no reserve. This was a fraudulent bet that AIG was making, except that when they did go broke, which was entirely predictable, we the taxpayers got called on to bail them out, and by extension, bail out Goldman Sachs and the rest of these fraudsters.
Now, one of the things that they did that originally seemed smart in order to hedge against possible losses was that they bundled subprime loans of a weaker character with those of a stronger character, and also with prime loans into these big bundles of securitized mortgages. And at one point, I was talking with David K. Johnston, who used to write for the New York Times. And I said, well, David, this seems like a smart way to bundle things so that the potential losses are spread around and mixed together with performing loans. And he said, Peter, let's say you've got two packages of hamburger in your refrigerator. And he said, one of them's a little older than the other, and it has started to turn green. He said, are you going to mix those together into a meatloaf?
very good. Yeah, but what they did, that's exactly what they did, and then they took out a spray can and spray painted it gold and got a ratings agency to label it AAA.
Now
the ratings they label it AAA. It's exactly what happened.
And those ratings agencies played a critical role in enabling this whole heist, did they not, Leslie?
Yes, they did. We have a someone who was a senior ratings agency person in the film, Frank Rader, who was at S&P. You know, Frank came in, was in, he tells one anecdote about how he was asked to rate something. He was told to guess, you know, by someone in his firm, a rating. And the fundamental problem is the ratings agencies were being paid by the investment banks. It's an inherent conflict of interest. And if you're getting, you know, a nice slice of cash every time you give something AAA, it's human nature, I suppose, but you just keep wanting calling everything AAA. And the system worked so that you would bundle a bunch of mortgages together, bundle the bonds, put them into a CDO. Then you would take out the really risky stuff in the middle, the B stuff, put them into another CDO, and call it AAA.
Now, let me ask you to turn here to a slightly different aspect of this, because when I look at this as a somewhat impartial observer, I feel that you can say, okay, you know, things were in a go-go boom mode, and everybody was kind of just making a lot of money and grabbing the money as quickly as they could. And at a certain point, I believe this turned into criminal behavior. They knew what they were doing. They knew that these products were defective. They were passing them along, as you just said, Andrew, with gold spray paint on them and pretending that they were AAA when they knew very clearly that they were not. And so at what point did we cross over into criminal behavior? And do you have any expectation that those responsible will be held accountable?
Well, we wish. I mean, of course it should be held. We did cross into criminal behavior. There now are indictments against Mozilla of Countrywide. There is just an excess of timidity, I think, at the prosecutorial level. But on the other hand, there are these very important civil suits going on. I mean, we follow the city of Baltimore is suing Wells Fargo for alleging that Wells Fargo targeted minorities, African Americans, in Baltimore for these subprime loans, knowing that they would probably lose their houses down the line. And that's in violation of all sorts of civil rights era housing acts or anything else. State of Illinois just launched a similar suit against Wells Fargo again. I think these gentlemen, a lot of them are going to find themselves in court for a very long time. Whether or not they'll, you know, be taken away in chains is another matter. But I think the courts are the only way we're going to see any justice done here. There was talk of a, just like during the Depression, you had the PCORA Commission investigating what had been going on in Wall Street prior to 1929. And there was talk of setting up a similar thing here now. Seems to have faded away in this sort of desperate rush by the administration to compromise and paper over the cracks and forgive everybody.
Well, there are a couple of things there. Let me follow up. First of all, on the Baltimore Wells Fargo story, we have elements of racism here that I think need to be acknowledged. Going back 20 years, we had a problem called redlining when financial institutions wouldn't loan to black communities. And now we had a kind of blacklining where they were targeting African-American churches as a way to reach people and, you know, get some kind of credibility for their encounters with potential borrowers. We have the story of this one loan officer who made $700,000 in commissions in a single year, and she talked about the bank's policies that were clearly targeting subprime loans that would earn high commissions for her to her community. And I think that these things really need to be very carefully investigated, because they go beyond kind of the ordinary greed, if you will, that was endemic to the system. Leslie?
Yes, I think that's right. I think that also, by the way, the NAACP has also filed suit on similar lines. And I think that the reason why we probed into that aspect of all of this is because, you know, when you start targeting poor people in these situations, when you really go after people in order to get them into these loans, then it isn't just simple Wall Street greed, yet another deal done. It's really, it says something truly, truly awful about the state of the United States. And I think that in American Casino, the people who are hardest hit by this are the most eloquent talking about what it's done to all of us. It's, you know, the blaming the borrower, the whole talking about Americans as a consumer society as opposed to a society of citizens. I mean, I think all of this is very degrading, and I think that there will be criminal prosecutions coming out of this. I look forward to it.
Mm-hmm. And Andrew, as you look at this picture, does the Obama administration, you described prosecutorial timidity, but is it a conscious effort here? Number one, because we've put trillions of dollars, much more than Ben Bernanke acknowledged on PBS at those Kansas City town hall meetings a month ago, trillions of dollars into these institutions. We didn't nationalize them. We don't really control them. I mean, it's a really murky swamp that we have entered into. And Obama held over the economic team, essentially. I mean, Paulson moved on, but Geithner is just Paulson with hair. You know, I mean, we're still looking at the Goldman Sachs Alumni Association in one form or another. And it strikes me that Obama has consciously decided not to make an issue of criminality in the financial meltdown. And some people suggest that this is because he got his early money from Wall Street, from Goldman Sachs in particular, a very big bundling operation for the Obama campaign just a year ago. And others are also suggesting that in terms of this and in health care reform, that Rahm Emanuel is very consciously looking at what kind of money it's going to take to hold on to the Senate and House majorities in the next cycle, and that they're basically trading votes for money and forbearance for money. Your comments? Either one of you take that.
Well, obviously, you know, any politician today, particularly people now in the White House, I mean, they think a lot about, as you say, where the money's coming from. And it is certainly true that Wall Street is now the major political, in terms of, you know, in terms of money, the major political player. I mean, it's the first quarter of this year was $107 million they put in, money well spent, obviously, from their point of view. But I think that is certainly true, and it's certainly, you know, shocking and outrageous that these people, these greedy people who managed to, you know, collapse the system and have done untold damage in this very cruel way to ordinary people, should be able to buy their way out of trouble. But it's also, I think, that the administration, Obama, was kind of panicked. I mean, they panicked him into thinking, you know, if you don't give us all the money right away and don't, you know, and leave us alone with it, don't tell us how to spend it, you know, terrible things will happen. The whole system will collapse, and there'll be blood in the streets. You know, Obama said early this year, he told a group of bankers, he said, "My administration is the only thing standing between you and the pitchfork." Which, you know, we should all rise up and shout, "Why? Why are you standing in the way of the pitchfork? Get out of the way, Obama, and let justice take its course."
Leslie, do you have a comment on that?
Well, I think it's really, I've been very disturbed by how there's some really obvious regulations that need to be put in place, particularly, as you can see from American Casino, that the smart thing to do would be to say, well, that's actually illegal for banks to pay these ratings agencies. They should be paid by their investment clients. It's just an obvious, simple fix. That hasn't been done. And there are other obvious, simple fixes, like banks really need to have capital requirements. They need to put aside a lot of money. Derivatives, you know, in a number of cases, should be outlawed. None of this is happening. And there's a lot of money making sure that it's not happening. And I think that that's a problem. And then you suddenly hear all this green shoot stuff. Well, right now, 1 in 12 people who have a mortgage are seriously, seriously in trouble. Last year, that was 1 in 22, and the year before, that was 1 in 40. Sheila Bair, who's a very decent woman, by the way, over at the FDIC, she probably should have been Secretary of the Treasury. Sheila Bair is very nervous because right now the amount of money she has in her hands to support all of us if our banks go bust so that we get our money back is now $18 billion, and last year it was $52 billion. So there are some very serious problems here. Things are not over.
Well, I certainly agree, and I feel that Obama and Bernanke, perhaps not in a coordinated manner, are trying to talk us out of a depression. And I certainly don't want a depression. I'm not hoping for it. But the indicators to me don't support the rosy talk that we're hearing these days. You know, job loss, the rate of job loss has declined, and some consumer activity has picked up a little bit. But we don't see an end, particularly to the mortgage crisis. And we have two other batches of mortgages that will start to reset, I believe, over the next 18 to 24 months. And it appears that nobody's really sounding the alarm or at least warning people that we are not out of the woods yet.
Well, that's right. I mean, you know, I'll give you an example. Today, Wall Street jumped this morning, the market jumped because housing stocks, existing home sales were up 7%. Well, when you analyze those figures, first of all, you find those sinister words, seasonally adjusted, which means they've monkeyed around with statistics. What you actually get what the real figures break down to is they sold they sold 4,000 condos in the Northeast. Without that, without those sales, actually existing home sales would have been down. And anyway, existing home sales in the West, which is where the real mortgage crisis is centered, are down 10%. So, you know, you float, there's a sort of sliver of a headline is tossed out. And the market jumps, and you know people are supposed to believe that the crisis is over. But people know better. People know that you know their next door neighbor just got laid off, and they may be next. They know, you know, they're one of those one in eight people who's got a seriously delinquent mortgage. They, you know, you can't, this belief, as you mentioned, that, you know, Bernanke and Geithner and Obama are trying to talk us out of this crisis by making us all feel better, it just isn't going to work because people look at their own lives and know we're in serious trouble.
Mm-hmm. Leslie, recently the New York Times, on a Sunday lengthy piece, disclosed the conflict of interest that Henry Paulson had last September is when it really came into sharp focus. He had agreed when he left Goldman Sachs to become Treasury Secretary not to contact that firm, and he ultimately got a waiver from his pledge, but even before that, he was in regular contact with his successor, and we don't know exactly what they were talking about or you know, what kind of information was being exchanged there. But on the face of it, it appears that Paulson should be more deeply investigated. Where do you think that might ultimately go?
Well, I think he unquestionably should be carefully investigated on that. I think he should be hauled up on the Hill. And, you know, at the time, a lot of loose talk on Wall Street said, this is sure good for Goldman Sachs that Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns are going down. I think that Paulson needs to clear that up of why he was in such close contact with Blankfein, what they were doing, and why he got that waiver. I really want to know, and I think everyone else does.
Well, I think, I suspect we may well know already. He was looking after the interests of his old firm. I mean, the day they decided to save AIG, having let Lehman Brothers, major competitor of Goldman Sachs, go broke, one of the major... AIG's situation was a major problem for Goldman Sachs because Goldman had these huge bets with AIG, which they weren't going to get paid if AIG went broke. In that meeting to discuss that, the only person from Wall Street present, apart from Goldman, was Lloyd Blankfein from Goldman Sachs. I mean, on the face of it, it's conflict of interest is far too mild a term. But by the way, let's not just make Mr. Paulson the scapegoat. Larry Summers, Obama's chief economic advisor,
yes,
was on the payroll of D.E. Shaw,
right,
a major hedge fund. He was going around Asia while the mortgages were starting to subprime was collapsing here. He was going around Asia in 2007, early 2008, peddling these toxic securities to credulous Koreans and others. He was getting huge speaking fees from Goldman Sachs just before he took office.
Indeed.
I mean, the whole you need to. I think we just need to clear them all out. Deputy Secretary, you know, it's not just Goldman people. It's Citibank, Citigroup. You know, the other half of the administration that isn't Goldman is from Citigroup.
Mm-hmm. And Leslie and Andrew, as we wrap this up, could I ask you each to let me know who is still credible in this picture today? I would put forward the name Elizabeth Warren. She is the Harvard professor who is in charge of this TARP oversight committee that doesn't appear to have much leverage over the process other than to go public and say this doesn't make sense. But she's been very articulate and I think very honest. Are there others who we can look to for credible commentary on this economic situation?
Absolutely. I think in American Casino, you meet Michael Greenberger. Michael was a U.S. government regulator. He was on the Commodity Futures Trading Commission and tried to, in 1998, he tried to make it illegal to use these credit default swaps. He tried to really stop the rot as early as that and was run over by a herd that included Larry Summers and the entire banking lobby, so it didn't happen. But I would put forth Michael Greenberger. I would say that Sheila Bair over at FDIC should be recognized for what a really great job she's done. I would elevate her to a higher position.
Yeah, I mean, as others, it's very disturbing the way the team. I mean, Summers and Geithner. Well, Summers and behind him Robert Rubin, his old master, who helped run Citigroup into the ground, and former Secretary of Treasury. They've excluded people. Like not only people like Michael Greenberger, who should certainly be there, but also Joseph Stiglitz, two-time Nobel Prize winner in economics, who, by the way, has said has called our film shocking and powerful, and says everyone should go see it. Paul Volcker, you know, the hugely respected former chairman of the Fed, he's on the list as on the books as being an advisor, but we absolutely know for a fact. That Summers has blocked all access for him with the president. Mm. So it's we've had this little creepy little coup in the economic administration by which the people with power are restricted to those who caused this disaster in the first place.
Well, I want to thank you both for chatting with me today, and thank you even more for this powerful documentary, American Casino. It's showing in San Francisco this weekend at the Roxy Theater. And it opens at the Film Forum in New York City on September 2nd. And is there a website for the film that people can get more information?
Absolutely. It's AmericanCasinoTheMovie.com.
Very good.
American Casino the Movie, all one word.
Nice to talk with you, Andrew Coburn, Leslie Coburn. Best wishes and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Hey, thank you.
Here we go, starting another war. We got our heads up our asses. You know, we're really bored. Hey, we're the Republicans.
We continue on the Peter B. Collins Show, and our official film reviewer, Gary Chu, joins us from Sacramento to talk about a movie that you could say relates to how we got into Iraq. If you can remember way, way back there to 2002 and 2003, the film is called In the Loop. Gary, welcome to the show today.
Hi, Peter B. Good to be with you again.
Well, it's good to talk with you. And this time, I've seen the film, and it's always fun to compare notes with you as a professional film viewer. And I think In the Loop is something that a lot of my listeners would enjoy. It is a satire, and people might find it a little frustrating. It's in a British sense of humor and sensibility. And it's not specifically, it's not explicitly about Bush and Blair and the precedents to the invasion of Iraq. But you certainly can construe it that way if you want.
You certainly can. Absolutely. It's the only, you know, since you started out with it'd be frustrating, the two things that strike me as frustrating, and I'll get past those in a moment, and that is the film is exceedingly fast, very speedy.
Yeah.
The dialogue is very fast and in various kinds of English accents, which sometimes are difficult to understand. And the handheld cameras sort of drive me nuts, personally.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only thing that really bothered me. Otherwise, I thought it was an exhilarating film. And what I think is neat about it, Peter V. It opens the door for young filmgoers today to go back, check out YouTube or my review on TulsaTVMemories.com, because my webmaster has linked the trailer to Dr. Strangelove in the body of my text, and watching that preview is very important to kind of get the idea of what In the Loop is about, because it's not about, it's not obviously as heavy as Dr. Strangelove, because that's about as heavy as you can get, but funny. And this film is sort of approaches it in its absurdity and the silliness of all the people. Do you feel that?
I do. Yeah, and I think that it's powerful in many ways, and I don't need an explicit review and recap of what happened, because I lived it and followed it, and I probably know more than I'd like to about the Downing Street memos and things like that. But you see human beings in these highly charged political situations, and they respond the way, for example, many of our generals did. James Gandolfini, who many people knew as Tony Soprano, plays an American general. And while I think that he wasn't the best person to cast for this, because it's kind of like Tony Soprano in a general's uniform, I think that he did serve up the kind of conflicts that many of our military brass felt as they saw us rushing into a war that they didn't feel very good about, and they certainly weren't convinced by the way that intelligence was fixed around the policy, as that famous Downing Street memo told us.
I've heard some other people talk about Gandolfini's role in the film, and they compared it to a little bit of maybe a sort of a Colin Powell approach, you know, of a moderate, you know, he's obviously sort of a closet dove in the film, but has to foster himself a little more hawkish.
Yeah.
And this is, I made the comparison in my review, it's the complete opposite of the role in Dr. Strangelove that George C. Scott plays, one of my favorite characters in that movie, of Dr. Coretta, General Buck Turgis, if you remember him.
I do.
It's just the opposite. And so there are little parallels like that. I'm not sure if the Amando Iannucci, who directed and wrote some of the film, had that in mind or not, but it's certainly, because Strangelove is such a powerful film from such about 1964, I think, it strikes me as something to make a comparison of, because we have powerful, important, well-paid, educated people dealing with stuff that affects, you know, a lot of people on this earth, you know, and we want them to do it as as forthrightly and as honestly as they possibly can, with our interests in mind.
Mm-hmm.
And you get that's where the funny part is, plus the ridiculousness of I think director Tucker in it, played by Peter Capaldi, I think is his name.
Right.
He's, you know, he drops F-bombs about every other line in
that's
the dialogue.
Right. Yeah.
And it is pretty funny, and it's quite the coarse language. So some people may be bothered by that, but you know, most people are grown up today; they can handle the F-word.
Sure. Yeah. Well, what I thought was interesting too was the interplay between that character, Malcolm Tucker, and Simon Foster.
Mm-hmm.
And Foster is played by an actor named Tom Hollander, who I think served it up very well, because he's squirming throughout the whole film. He, early in the film, gives an interview where he perhaps gets off the talking points just a little, not a whole lot, but just a little, and he's trying to reel back his words and keep his ass out of trouble through the rest of the film. And this had personal impact for me, Gary, because a few years back, and I peg it in 2005, I had an opportunity to meet the U.S. ambassador to Britain, and we chatted over a lunch in a noisy restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
His name is Sir David Manning, and he was the author of the Downing Street memo. He's the one who wrote the memo to Blair saying that, and this was in the summer of 2002, these guys are going to war, and they are fixing the policy, they're fixing the intelligence around the policy. And Manning is one of these, you know, unfailingly polite Brits who, you know, is almost stereotypical. He was quite a diplomat. At the time I spoke to him, he was still on message and would not deviate from his, at least public support of Bush and Blair's war. but I could kind of see that he was very interested, while maintaining his posture, in hearing the critical comments that I had to offer. And in that, again, I read between the lines that he was eager to bust out of his diplomatic straitjacket and be able to say, you know, you're right, this whole thing sucks.
Mm-hmm. But obviously couldn't do it at that particular time.
Right. Mm-hmm. And the other character who is quite rewarding for me is Mimi Kennedy, plays the role of this American diplomat who apparently had an affair in the past with the Gandolfini character. But what's delicious about this is she's the one who doesn't believe the bogus intelligence and who doesn't want to rush into this military conflict. And Mimi Kennedy is one of the founders of Progressive Democrats of America.
No.
And so for her to be able to come out of the Dharma and Greg role from years past and get on the big screen in a role like this, I think was extremely satisfying for her.
Well, you know, I really liked her. First of all, I like her haircut.
Yeah.
Her hair in the film, you know. She was just right as a sort of a little bit edgy like Hillary Clinton, but a little maybe more breezy.
Mm-hmm.
In the character, and then when they load you down toward the end of the film, that she and General Miller Gandolfini have been intimate in the first past, and then they're sort of still hassling each other about it, that even made it funnier.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was also funny when the young gal Anna Chomsky, an American aide, starts checking it out with one of the Brit aides in it, too. That was kind of a funny...
Come on, Gary, it's a podcast. You can say Jumpin' Bones.
Oh, okay, Jumpin' Bones. All right. You know, I'm so used to talking on the radio, you know, and all that stuff. I mean, almost as much as you are, I shouldn't say those things.
Yeah.
Even my reviews, when I relate to Capaldi using the F word, I've got spell it F star C K.
Right. Yes,
so
you do.
No, I just don't. I want to do it like Jon Stewart does.
Well, anything else you want to add? Because I do recommend this film for our listeners, particularly people who enjoy a good satire. Because I think you have to embrace that to understand the zeitgeist here.
I agree with you. The thing of it is, it's really fast, and people must go in and give it 105% of their attention, and there's even a little kicker on the end after the credits that you need to stick by for. Good film. I love satires, and nobody can do satire like the British, for sure.
Yeah. Well, Gary, thanks for joining us today, and we'll see you at the movies.
Okay. Good to talk to you.
Thanks for joining me for this edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Tell your friends, spread the word, and give me your feedback, peter@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.